Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
And we're in depth on the healing of music. That's the music that Andrew Schulman, in the depths of a coma, had heard, and it pulled him out of that coma. He'd gone into the hospital for surgery on what would be a benign tumor in his pancreas, only to nearly die from some mysterious complications. Unsure what else to do, Andrew's wife Wendy brought an iPod into his hospital room and filled his ears with music. That experience made Andrew Schulman a powerful witness to the healing that music could bring in a hospital, and it would set him on an unexpected path. As Andrew joins us this morning, I'd love to hear from you about a piece of music that was essential to healing. Maybe it gave you the momentum to conquer an injury or an illness. Maybe it's music that someone in your life with memory problems responds to. I'd like to hear from you this morning on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and I've just tweeted out a question on it, at Carrie NPR. Andrew Schulman's book is titled Waking the Spirit, A Musician's Journey, Healing Body, Mind, and Soul, and he joins us today from New York City. Andrew, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, hi, Carrie. Quick question. Was there some kind of debate last night? I walked in here and I kept hearing the word debate.
My friend, it's about healing and music this hour, not about politics and what happened last night. Good to have you here. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
So that music that we were playing at the beginning is Bach's St. Matthew Passion, and the nurses around you called this the St. Matthew Miracle. Let's hear a little bit more of it, and you can tell me why, okay?
Okay.
Okay, the St. Matthew Miracle. Why?
Well, because I was desperately ill after a surgery, and I was in a coma, and I'd been in a coma for 3 days without a single person in this surgical ICU thinking I'm going to live. And my wife, Wendy, had been at my side all of her waking hours, and I was getting great care, but I was dying. I was literally terminally ill on the third day. I had terminal acid buildup in my tissues, and my vital signs were falling, and Wendy could tell from looking at the nurses and overhearing a little bit what they were saying, and she knew how to read the computer monitor with my vital signs, and she knew that I was dying. And at that moment, in the middle of the third day, around noon, it was a Sunday, she had an epiphany and realized that in her feeling, the only thing that could save me was music. That she turned to the attending physician who was just starting to walk by and told him that she thought that was the case. She told him, I love music more than anything. And this, of course, is my wife saying this, but she knew we'd been married 25 years then. And she had my iPod with her and asked permission to put the iPod in. And he said, yes. A lot of doctors would have said no, wouldn't have taken the risk.
Really?
He said I could hear it for 30 minutes, but if there was any sign of agitation, to remove the earbud immediately. And he told her to put one earbud in her ear, the other in mine. And they didn't know what to play. First of all, she didn't even know how to use an iPod, but a medical student who'd been with me in the surgery was there, wonderful guy, who took care of that. And the question was what to play. And they just said, well, hit the first track. And that was one of a number of things in those first days after my surgery that saved my life. The very first track was BWV 244, the St. Matthew Passion of Johann Sebastian Bach. It was the 1962 recording by Leonard Bernstein in the New York Philharmonic and Great Singers, and was my ultimate favorite piece of music. And the music began, and by the time the 30 minutes was up, everybody was looking up and totally amazed because my vital signs began to stabilize. I hadn't been stable for a second in 3 days. And by the end of the afternoon, the acid had receded from my tissues, and by that evening, they said I was out of the woods.
Andrew, I presume that you don't remember hearing that music.
I certainly do. There's something
what?
Called coma dreams.
You do?
Yes. There's something called coma
dreams. I couldn't tell
dreams.
From your book whether you were actually aware of the music in that
yeah.
state.
Coma dreams are not really dreams. They're a dreamlike state that you're in. When a person is in a coma, they can hear everything. And it is not heard, though, not just in real time. It's heard in real time,
mm-hmm.
but it's not translated as the reality everybody else is experiencing.
Like full consciousness of it.
Yes, it's
okay.
not. Actually, what it is, that's why we call it coma dreams, or just better to think dreamlike state. So in the dreamlike state I was in, and this is in chapter 3 of the book, I was walking down a street in an old suburban area like where I grew up, but it wasn't my street. Similar enough, though. And it was Christmas time. Now, keep in mind, that day was July 19th in the New York summer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Christmas, and I have a heavy coat. I'm carrying my guitar, and I'm so slow walking, and the guitar is so heavy, and I can't understand why I'm so tired. And I'm looking for the home of the widow, because every Christmas I played for the widow. And I finally find the house and knock on the door, and the door opens, and there's a woman there in her 80s, and it's actually red hair turned gray, blue eyes. It's my wife. I'm dreaming that my wife is the widow who I'm going to play for. And I played for her every Christmas, and I go into the dining room area where we always set it aside, and this table with cakes and everything. And she's very, very somber, very, very somber. And I take my guitar, but it's so heavy I can barely play it. And why is this Christmas time? Why is it, am I playing for the widow? Because the nurses in our surgical ICU have an expression called a Christmas tree. A Christmas tree is when a patient has 3 or 4 of the aluminum stands laden with the bags of medicine, and it's a last-ditch effort. Basically, when somebody has a Christmas tree, they're about to die. It's the last-ditch effort. And also, why is it the widow? Because Dr. Marvin McMillan, who was the SICU director at the time there, had an expression that if a man was the patient and died, he would tell the nurses to come and get him so he could give his black bunting speech to the widow.
Wow.
And so I can hear everything. I'm in a coma, but I hear everything and see how it's translated.
Yeah.
Amazing, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, yeah.
So
is.
I take my guitar out in the beginning of the stream, and I wrote this dream out in the book. Spoiler alert, but too late. And I get the guitar out, and I'm exhausted, and I can't understand why I'm so tired. And I couldn't play. But all of a sudden, I look down, and my hands are moving. And I'm playing this amazing music, and I'm filled with joy, but I cannot understand how I'm playing this music because I've never played it before. And it was the Bach being played through the iPod. And I look up, and I see the widow sitting in the chair against the wall, and she has tears in her eyes, but she's smiling. And excuse me, I'm getting a little choked up there. I haven't told this story in a while, so it's pretty emotional. But and that was the turning point. Now, my doctors, the director of the SICU, my surgeon, Dr. Martin Carpe Jr., and the nurses all attest, and that we actually have there's been a documentary short made, a 30-minute wonderful film was made 2 years ago. And in the film, they attest to that it was the music that turned it around, and that's why it's the St. Matthew miracle.
Andrew, you are and were an accomplished musician before this. You had memorized, I think you say in the book, 300 songs. You could play from memory before this.
Right.
You came out of the coma remembering only, what, five or six?
Right. Yeah. When I came out of the coma, no one was actually certain at all what the deal was going to be, because I was in cardiac arrest for 2 minutes, but I was in brain ischemia for 17 minutes. And when I came out of the coma, the very first person I saw, it was 3 a.m. when I'm finally out of the coma, but it's at 8 when Wendy comes in, and I look up from the bed and I go, "Hi, Wendy." And that was a once in a lifetime smile. No slurred speech. I knew who it was. And for the next few days, everybody thinks, "Oh my God, this guy escaped any brain damage," but he didn't. And it is on the 12th day in the hospital where I get the okay to go home. They thought I'd be there 2 months, between 2 and 3 months. It was 12 days. And I go home, and it wasn't the first moment picking up. When I walked into the apartment, you can imagine, here's this guy who's been through all this stuff. What's the very first thing I do? I walk to the front of the apartment. My guitar is on a stand. I pick it up. I sit down, and there is a piece. I have my guitar right here.
I was just going to ask you. Good.
Okay. So there is a Bach piece on the stand that I had just arranged, which I had never played. I'd never memorized, actually. So I had the sheet music there. It's the Saraband from the Third Lute Suite by Bach, which is the same melody as the final chorus of the St. Matthew Passion. How's that for irony? And I pick it up, and normally it goes... But when I picked that up, I was able to play something like this. Well, you get the idea. I could barely play. I'd become a 4-year-old in 12 days.
Still sounds beautiful, though. I want you to know that.
Oh, thank you. And it's amazing, great piece. But I read through it, and it's a 5-minute piece, and it took me 15 minutes to play it. And when I finished playing it, I was wiped out. I was so exhausted, I slept for 2 hours. The next day, though, I picked up the guitar, and Wendy was nearby doing something, and her favorite piece of everything I play is the Prelude No. 4 by Villa-Lobos, the Brazilian composer, which begins like this. Okay, I got the first two notes out, and my mind went blank. It just went blank. I couldn't play it. And I started to try some other tune, various tunes, all favorite tunes. I couldn't get more than one or two or three notes, and then my mind would absolutely go blank. Mm. So I first attributed that to the physical trauma I'd been through, but I also noticed, I left this out on the day before when I did the Bach. As soon as I started playing, there was a sharp pain in the left side of my forehead. It's almost as if somebody was poking me with an ice pick or something. And again, I attribute everything to physical trauma. But what happens is each ensuing day, I realize I really can't play anything from memory. But I do discover eventually there are 6 pieces, 2 Bach preludes, 2 Beatles songs, and 2 Spanish pieces I can play. And here's cutting to the chase on the brain damage thing is that, and this is in the book, a surmise by Dr. Mark Tramo, because they didn't do brain scans when I was in the hospital. They had other things to worry about, like my dying. So I really put on a great show for them. I kept everybody very busy that week. So what I had, and I love the technical description, I had bilateral shrinkage of the hippocampus with retrograde amnesia and anterograde amnesia, meaning the hippocampus is kind of in the middle brain, a fairly small section of the brain that has to do with storing memories. And it's bilateral. It's on the right and left hemisphere of the brain. Retrograde amnesia is loss of new memories first. Anterograde amnesia is the inability to play from anterograde is the inability to make new memories, and bilateral shrinkage of the hippocampus is fairly common in cases where there is not enough oxygen to the brain. And very interestingly, the brain damage you'll get hit with will go to the part of the brain you use the most.
Wow.
And as a musician who spent his life memorizing music, it was something between later on, I kind of figured out a little bit, but it was between 12 and 15 hours worth of music I had memorized.
Nice.
Everything was gone except those six pieces. And then what Tramo found so interesting is I was able to trace back and say those six tunes I could remember, I memorized before the age of 20, and I had played them all through my life. And that involves something called Ribot's gradient, R-I-B-O-T, it was a French doctor in the 19th century who theorized that on retrograde amnesia, there was a gradient to it. So it didn't necessarily go back to the very first thing I ever learned how to play.
Right.
It went back, to about the age of 20.
Andrew, let me ask you to do this, if you will, because we have a number of people that want to talk to you. Mm-hmm. You just said you came out of the hospital and realized you still had memories of five or six songs, two of them Beatles songs.
Right.
Would you play one of the two Beatles songs that you remember?
I can't remember it.
I don't believe that. If you've just tuned in to the conversation, he's playing his guitar in a studio in New York, and I'm having a conversation with him about his new book, Waking the Spirit, A Musician's Journey Healing Body, Mind, and Soul. And I've asked you to think about, as I have this conversation with Andrew, about a piece of music that was essential to healing in your life. Maybe it gave you the momentum to conquer an injury or an illness or a trauma of some kind. Maybe it's music that someone in your life with memory problems responds to. Love to hear from you on this, and I think Andrew would like to have a conversation with you as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. And Andrew, could we take a call?
Sure.
That's beautiful.
Perfect timing.
That's beautiful. So nicely done.
Thank you.
To Kathleen in St. Paul. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to comment the fact that the Health East hospitals recognize the importance of music, and that I play, for example, every Tuesday at St. Joe's. They have a marvelous grand piano, woodwinds also, but they have other volunteer musicians playing. And the sound just sort of wafts up to the third floor, and they have gotten lots of good comments from various people going through different surgeries that it really helps their healing hearing this music. I know that there are doctors also who, before you go into surgery, will ask what your favorite music is and will play it during the surgery.
Wow.
That they find that it helps regulate blood pressure.
Kathleen, what do you usually play? What's a favorite song to play when you're there?
Oh, I will play all sorts of soft jazz, Oscar Peterson type, Bill Evans type, but then also Yanni. And there are various arrangements of classical music that feed into hymns because of the fact that St. Joe's is a Catholic foundation.
So a variety of music. Yeah,
exactly.
I'm really glad you heard the show. Thanks so much for calling in. To Gen Z in St. Louis Park. Hey, Gen Z, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good to have you call. You're a friend of Andrew's, is that right?
Yes.
She sure is.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Gen Z.
We haven't yet met in person, but my husband Greg and I are close online friends of Andrew, and we're thrilled you're on, and we are just so inspired by your work and by Waking the Spirit. And I especially want to thank you, Andrew, for kind of giving me my full spark back for playing the Great American Songbook and my own gigs for people. I volunteer and play recorder and ukulele for folks who have memory loss, and playing songs from 75 to 80 years ago that they remember just really brings folks back to themselves, and it's inspirational in itself. But having read the Dina chapter of Waking the Spirit just totally gave me such a spark back for that. So thanks for that and all you do. And my question about Waking the Spirit is quickly, it reads effortlessly, like it just naturally and organically flowed out of you, but you're writing about such transcendent and emotional experiences. I don't see how it couldn't have been very challenging to put all that into such eloquent words.
Jenzi, thanks for the question. Andrew, what would you say?
Well, again, thanks for everything you just said, Jenzi. And I love what you do, and you're making a great contribution in so many ways with music and healing and teaching. It's wonderful. Now, people have asked about the writing because this, first of all, is my first book. And the book begins really the day I returned to the hospital as a musician in January 2010, because I began a journal, and a very, very detailed journal of every single day I was in there, which was for the first 6 months. And within a few weeks, I started sending it to friends. And the first thing that I heard back was everybody going, "You have to write a book." The other thing that happened was crucial was one of my friends, one of my longest, oldest friends in terms of years, a woman named Beth Mead, who lives in Delaware. Beth was a retired psychotherapist and also an amateur musician. Her husband's a doctor, Lyndon, also a musician. And Beth took on the role of being my first reader, which I really encouraged her to do. She started making edits, line edits to what I was doing. For instance, not only did I not know that I did a lot of run-on sentences, I didn't even know what a run-on sentence was. So Beth really started getting me to think like a writer. And then the process continues, and putting anybody who's written a book, especially a nonfiction book, knows it's a tremendous process you go through of sample chapters, a book proposal, et cetera, et cetera. But the flow that the book has, to answer that question very directly now, is a very interesting backstory. And this is the first interview where I'm going to give this little backstory, which is simply that I had a first editor. As a first-time writer for a major publisher, I had to bring in my own editor. And because, my writing would need a lot more help than a professional writer's editing. And I had a very good book advance. I was able to, pay for an editor from that. I had an editor for the first year, and all I'll say is this was a very highly respected person and very accomplished and a very, very good editor, but we weren't on the same page. And I was too inexperienced to know that from the beginning. A year went by, and we finally realized that book was not going to go anywhere. That relationship was actually getting negative. And this happens. I don't blame anybody. It just happens. So we parted ways, but I'd already had two extensions to my deadline. And it's a great risk that a publisher takes in a situation like this. And a couple more months went by, and Wendy tried helping with editing. I kind of stopped writing. And luckily, through an amazing thing, which I'm not going to tell, it's too long a story to tell, but because one of my dogs died and I went to the dog run with a puppy, I met the editor who did the rest of the book with me. Her name is Lindsay Tate. She's English but lives in New York with her husband and children. And she had a dog. I met her in the dog run in Riverside Park. But we had 3 months left before this carved in stone deadline. And we worked 24 hours a day for 3 months. I wrote from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 in the morning, and she edited from 7:30 a.m. until 4:30 in the afternoon. We wrote 16 chapters. I wrote 16 chapters. She edited 16 chapters in 12 weeks. And so the flow that is in that book comes out of that. But we had a wonderful time. My nickname for Lindsay is the brilliant Lindsay Tate. And the only thing negative I have to say about Lindsay is that she laughs at all my jokes. So I don't know if that came out right, but you know what I mean.
Andrew,
we got along great. Yeah.
Andrew Shulman is with us. I just want to remind people what they're listening to here, Andrew. And we're talking about his book, Waking the Spirit. And I'm asking you this morning for music that has been meaningful to you in the midst of recovery from an illness or an injury or a trauma. Nicole says, I dealt with three deaths in 1999, and I had Sarah McLachlan surfacing on repeat for months. Steph, off the page.
Lori says, most music from Naco Bear and Medicine for the People. It's definitely not classical music, not sacred in the classical sense, but definitely sacred to your spirit. And someone going by Khan says, over the past 2 years, I've experienced being diagnosed with a brain tumor. Fortunately benign, but complicated in location, treated surgically, undergone radiation, and now in recovery. I'm learning to live with a hearing loss on one side, vision complications, and permanent pain. Through it all, I have found music to be my salvation. On solo road trips, I play my favorite songs from my youth. Van Morrison, Jackson Brown, and Boz Scaggs. Works even with unilateral hearing.
To Judy in Minneapolis. Hi, Judy. What's your experience with this?
My sister had what we now know was a congenital heart problem, and she suffered cardiac arrest and was down, as it were, for over 7 minutes. They got her heart started again, but when she arrived at the hospital, she was unconscious and in very serious state. And they told us to expect her to die because very few sudden cardiac arrest patients live. We, sort of expecting that, brought her favorite music, which was hymns, a CD sung by the Valparaiso University Choir, and organ music, particularly the organ music played by Paul Mons, and she is now going on 11 years of what she calls her rebirth day. We could tell it was making a difference because in a very short time we could see her eyes moving and her finger twitching, and then she kind of grabbed my finger. She had some response. But they had, really told us to expect her to die. And I too, feel like it was the music that reached her. She does not, as your guest does, she does not have any memory.
I was going to ask you about it. Yeah. How is she today, Judy?
She suffered some traumatic brain injury and has some short-term memory difficulties. Mm-hmm. And she was a medical writer and wasn't able to continue with that because of her short-term memory difficulties, but doing well and active every day. And
the music helps.
She was bicycling when it happened and still bicycles.
It's good to hear. I'm glad for the call, Judy. Thanks much. Lynn says on Twitter, 3 days before my father died, he played country music with the hospice musician for an hour and a half. Music soothed his soul. And to Steve in St. Paul. Hi, good morning, Steve.
Good morning. So my girlfriend's father has a frontotemporal lobe dementia, mm-hmm. and at this point it's pretty advanced. He really doesn't recognize anyone anymore. And girlfriend grew up listening to a lot of Bob Dylan in her house, and really the last time she felt he had any recognition of her, she had brought in a bunch of Bob Dylan and just sat with him. I'm sorry, it's a little emotional for me.
Steve, did it seem that he responded to the Dylan music?
He did. He knew who she was and where he was. And with that sort of dementia, there's a real degradation of personality, and people tend to become very agitated, and he went into a very calm and peaceful place, and there was a very real connection able to be had there through that music.
Steve, I appreciate the call. Andrew Shulman's with us. We're talking about his book, Waking the Spirit, and about the power of music as you recover from a trauma or an illness or an injury. We'll continue our discussion.
Time is running backwards, and so is the bride. Ring them bells, St. Peter, where the four winds blow. Ring them bells with an iron hand so the people will know. Oh, it's rush hour now on the wheel and the plow. And the sun is a-going down upon the sacred cow.
To Phil Picardi now for the latest news. Hi, Phil. I hope you're enjoying some of this music. It's great, isn't
indeed,
it?
Indeed, Carrie, it is. Thank you very much. Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine says the presidential debate showed Hillary Clinton has Donald Trump beat when it comes to stamina. Trump doubled down at the end of the debate on his frequent criticism that Clinton lacks the stamina to be commander-in-chief. She shot back by ticking off the busy schedule she kept as Secretary of State. Kaine said Clinton looked like she could have debated for 11 more hours, but she said Trump looked rattled and like a boxer leaning on the ropes waiting for a knockout. Donald Trump, meanwhile, is issuing his report card for Hillary Clinton for her debate performance, C+. Trump also says moderator Lester Holt of NBC News earned a C or a C+. He says Holt asked him unfair questions, but Trump isn't giving himself a letter grade for his own performance. He told Fox News he's confident he did much better than Clinton. Syrian State TV says government forces have captured a central rebel-held neighborhood in the northern city of Aleppo. It says troops captured the area near Aleppo's famous citadel, and fighting was underway in the same area near the historic city center. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights confirmed government forces are advancing in central Aleppo. And the National Weather Service has lowered its forecast for the Cedar River's crest in Cedar Rapids. The river is now expected to crest in Iowa's second largest city at just over 22 feet rather than 23 feet. That's 10 feet above flood stage and considered major flooding, but it's still 9 feet below the record crest in 2008 that caused devastating flooding in the city. Forecasters expect the river to crest in the next few hours. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:41.
On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer asks the questions that need to be answered.
How is Abbott Northwestern holding up with so many nurses on strike?
I can say all of our units.
Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, a break from debate talk. You'll hear Brant Williams' story about driving while black in the Twin Cities. And then you'll hear the first episode of a new podcast from my colleagues at APM Reports and The Washington Post, tied to the new Smithsonian Museum of African American History that brings that history to life. That's at 11.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Alexandria, Minnesota, offering hundreds of lakes, trails, and activities to explore all year round. Detailed information on places to stay and places to visit at explorealex.com.
Conversation this hour with Andrew Shulman. He thinks of himself or is a medical musician, and his new book is called Waking the Spirit. And Andrew, I chose that song because that's a song that you played in a medical ward where you ended up meeting some people who were instrumental to the lyrics of that song.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Over the Rainbow. It's chapter 10 in the book, Getting to the Other Side of the Rainbow. And this chapter is about ICU delirium, which is a major concern now, increasing concern in intensive care units. Because the intensive care unit is fantastic for the doctors in that the upgrades in technology have done so much to help save lives. But it's a very cold environment, and it's filled with the sounds of machines beeping. It's impersonal, so on and so forth. And there are people who could, especially the combination of somebody who's in a lot of pain, and if it's a very sensitive person to sounds and noises, et cetera, can slip into a condition that's called ICU delirium. It's very dangerous. And that's what that chapter is about. The patient in that chapter, and Gen Z mentioned this chapter, actually, she loved that chapter. Dina Rosenberg is the founder emeritus of the music theater program at the Tisch School of the Arts at New York University. And her husband is Ernie Harburg. I didn't know that for the first 2 days on their Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays in the SICU playing for 90 minutes to 2 hours each time. She was in serious ICU delirium on the Monday and the Tuesday. And I intuited the Great American Songbook. I started playing a lot of Gershwin and Rogers and Irving Berlin. It made a tremendous difference, as a reader can see in the chapter. And by the Friday when I came in, when I walked in with my guitar, a nurse walked over to me very, very excited and said, "You see that man over there with that with the patient in bed six? His father wrote the lyrics to Over the Rainbow."
Wow.
So I went over to both of them. I didn't know who they were until that moment. And this was Ernie Harburg. His father was Yip Harburg, the great lyricist of Over the Rainbow, Paper Moon, and so many other great, great songs. We chatted a few minutes, and then I said, "I have a really nice tune to play for you." I hadn't played that particular song yet. And I went to my sitting position about 8 feet from them and played the tune. And that was actually the final moment of bringing Dina Rosenberg back into this world. It was extraordinary. It's like watching somebody pouring water over a wilted flower and the flower completely revives.
Well, would you play a little bit more of Over the Rainbow? Would that be all right?
Sure.
Says on Twitter, it was the soothing traditional South African singing of Ladysmith Black Mambazo that coaxed me through 12 hours of childbirth. Ben says, "I'm a songwriter and a suicide survivor. A lot of music helped my recovery. I like to keep myself in pain by Kelly Hogan in particular." And Steph off the page.
Scott says, "This is such an important topic and one that sadly receives little attention. I witnessed the power and miracle of music as a healing force when my father was in the ICU after suffering a traumatic episode. His heart rate had begun to decrease and the doctors had indicated that there wasn't anything more they could do. A piece my dad had recorded in 1957 brought him back. What was extraordinary was watching my dad appear to be processing the performance as he came out of his unconsciousness."
Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Call from Jill in Coon Rapids. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Shulman, for writing that book. That is absolutely wonderful that you've drawn attention to this topic. My experience was with pain control with the music. After having surgery, I'm unable to take narcotics, and I had had an extremely extensive abdominal surgery with severe, severe pain, unable to take anything at home. And I used listening. It was amazing when I would listen to some South African gospel music that I absolutely love. It would diminish that pain so markedly. It was unbelievable. And as soon as the music stopped playing, that pain was right there. But as soon as I started it again, the pain was extremely diminished. And I'm convinced it was because of the release of natural endorphins caused by listening to the music. And thank you again very much for writing the book.
Jill,
we
have a little gospel music because Heather mentioned this too, helping her through 12 hours of childbirth. Let's listen.
Everything's so stupid.
That's great. You know, Andrew, here's the thing I was curious about is whether enough medical institutions are turning to medical musicians like you, or is there still some skepticism out there about the value of this?
I'll give you a quick overview. The field I'm in is called the field of music and medicine. The core profession is called music therapy.
Mm-hmm.
The hospital at Beth Israel, where I play, I'm also at Berkshire Medical Center, but at Beth Israel, they have a music therapy department. They do lots of things in many different kinds of situations. Music therapists are trained to do many different kinds of things. My interest was only in critical care because that's where I come from in terms of having been a patient. And so I'm not a music therapist. What I do is not music therapy. And I realized, though, right from the beginning that I knew I was very dedicated to doing this. I've been doing it 7 years now. So the idea was to come up with a term, and I read history about this stuff. And Pythagoras, the famous Pythagoras of the Pythagorean theorem, had a school of music healing, and he called it musical medicine. And that's kind of where I got medical musician from. A medical musician is a professional musician who's had medical training, in my case, on the job, and works basically in critical care where the music is the medicine. And the caller we just had talking about pain, First of all, chapter 11 in my book is all about that. It's not an anecdotal patient story. I have several experts, Dr. Stephen Quensel and Dr. Ronald Wilson, who's a pain chief at Beth Israel, and Dr. Cameron Folapour, who's a neuroscientist. For those of you who are interested in understanding this, if you know, there's a thing called the gate control theory of pain, and that's what it's all about. So those chemicals that were made in the caller's brain, and that is what music does. Here's the super nutshell. Those chemicals flow through the body and especially into the dorsal horn of the spine, which is the key part of understanding how pain works in people, the nerve impulses of pain. And so the stimulus of pain flows through that dorsal horn of the spine through the body, and you're in terrible, terrible pain. Music creates wonderful chemicals, a whole bunch of them in the brain that flow down the spine through the central nervous system, and they have a big party in the dorsal horn of the spine, and they clog it up. And you feel there is less room for the bad pain stuff to come in, and that's why your pain is lessened.
Can I ask you to choose one of the songs that you play that's particularly meaningful to you and play us out?
Sure.
What would it be?
The first one that comes to mind is not only is it not a famous composer, he's not really a professional composer. It's a friend of mine. He's a guitar player. And he wrote a little tune. He just calls it Little Theme in D. And is the most miraculous piece when there's a situation where there's a patient who's very, very sick, and there could be 2, 3, 4 friends and family who are so weighted down with fear and anxiety. And I play this, and it just lifts everybody. Here it is, Little Theme in D by Peter Williams.
Andrew, thank you. Shulman's book is called Waking the Spirit, A Musician's Journey, Healing Body, Mind, and Soul, and you can read about it on The Thread.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.